Hello, this is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, and you're listening to our Modern Jewish History Series, Jews, Judaism, and Modernity, at webyeshiva.org. If you are only listening to the MP3 of this session, you're not getting the full experience. Visit us at webyeshiva.org to register for this and our full line of fully interactive online shiurim and classes. Okay, good evening. Tonight, we are going to speak about Hasidut, the Hasidic movement. In the last session, we discussed the events leading from the mid 17th century, precisely or specifically from 1648, up until the aftermath of those terrible pogroms, the Chmelnytsky pogroms of 1648-49 and the following years, and the impact that they had on Eastern European society, on religious life, and civilization, and society, and learning, and etc. And we mentioned that among the things that were indirect outgrowths of this was the rise of Hasidut. Hasidut, the most, really perhaps the most successful by in terms of sheer numbers and impact, most significant religious movement, perhaps, you know, in some ways, perhaps in all of Jewish history, is founded by Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, who lived from around the year 1700. Sometimes his date of birth is given as a year or two before, until 1760, which, of course, in the 18th century, to get to the age of 60 was a ripe old age. We often think of this when we hear that people were already it's like the expression dog years. It's 7 years for every year. That's not precisely so. When we say that people who lived in centuries ago, when we say that by the time they were 40 or 50, they were already old, isn't exactly correct. It's a question of the statistics. It's not that people... Are we recording? Hold on. It's not that... I'm sorry, 1 second. Thank you, Alan, for reminding me to record. There you go. It's not that people didn't live to ripe old age. They did. There were people that lived well into their 90s, and some even beyond. But statistically speaking, the average, when you look at the average lifespan, people died much, much younger. So to live to be into your 60s, you, in some ways, can be considered to have had a full life, but merely only statistically speaking. The Baal Shem Tov, Besht, he's also known as the Besht, is an acronym for Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael. Sometimes he's called Rabbi Yisrael, sometimes he's called the Besht, the Baal, or the Baal Shem Tov. The idea of a Baal Shem, the master of a name, or the master of a good name, these were kind of charismatic figures. The Besht was not the first person to have the title or the name Baal Shem. These were types of wonder workers or itinerant preachers and teachers and charismatic figures, but he kind of takes on the name the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov. He is the founder, effectively, of the largest mass movement of Jews, certainly in the modern era, and by sheer numbers, perhaps of all times. It's not the Hasidic movement in its origins is not a movement in the regular sense of the world. In the regular sense of the word, he, Rabbi Yisrael, the Baal Shem Tov, has a peculiar has a peculiar beginning. He's sometimes like a teacher in a cheder, in the traditional elementary school system. He's either a teacher or an assistant teacher in a cheder. At other times, he acts as a common laborer. He serves as a coachman, driving a coach, which was, I guess, the equivalent of being a taxicab driver in the earlier days. And sometimes he's just a wandering figure, traveling around large swaths of Eastern Europe, specifically the area that we today call the Ukraine. Again, this same area that's so much affected by those pogroms in the 17th century. And he's wandering around that. It, of course, the Ukraine in those days was essentially part of Poland, of a larger Poland. Chaim asks, yeah. So in other words, Chaim asks about the term cheder. Although it's interesting, I just ordered a book. There's a new anthology of writings about the cheder. You know, the traditional Eastern European system of education, edited by Professor Etkes. It's a book in Hebrew published by the Tel Aviv University Press, so I'm hoping to get that book, and I'll share anything interesting that I find there. The cheder was synonymous both with the room, the literal, the one-room, kind of the idea of the one-room schoolhouse, but it was also, the cheder also was a term used to describe the whole system of what's equivalent to what we call essentially elementary school education, which of course focused almost exclusively on the study of Torah Shebaal Peh, of Talmud. In the younger grades, they learned some Chumash, and of course they learned also how to read and how to write. And that's a few weeks ago we played that well-known tune Orphan Pripachek, the kind of the anthem of the cheder. Rabbi Yisrael, at a certain point, is considered to be an Am Haaretz, an ignoramus, a simpleton. If you had a chance to look at the section that I uploaded to the Shir homepage, and I would just really suggest that you make it a point to try to look on the Shir homepage and to see the things that I upload there, and it's worth your time to read them over in advance. It'll help us accomplish more together in our time during the class. He was, as it were, in disguise, or in hiding. People didn't know that they were in the presence of a spiritual giant. They actually took him to be an Am Haaretz, a common type of person. He gets married, although he spends a great amount of time in isolation. He goes off into the Carpathian Mountains, and at the age of 36, around the year 1736, he reveals himself as the Baal Shem, as a holy man, as a religious healer, as a figure. Here, I mean, you're just looking at a picture of his sidur in his own handwriting. This is his actual sidur, which is in the possession of the Chabad Hasidim, and it's on display at their they have a library of important manuscripts of Hasidism, of Hasidut. And if you find your way to Brooklyn, you can actually go see the Baal Shem Tov's own sidur. The story of his revelation is told in the Shivchei HaBesht. Let me just page forward. Oh, here you have his shul. This is a photo of from Medzibuch, which is today in the Ukraine, not in what today is called Poland. This was his shul. It was a simple wooden structure. It's a pretty iconic image. You see it reprinted elsewhere, both as an illustration and as a photograph. This is apparently a photograph taken in 1915. There's a replica of the building on that site today, but the building at some point was destroyed and rebuilt. Pardon me. There you go. Oh, hold on. I see. People didn't see the picture. One second. There you go. Okay, do you see it now, Chaim? Anybody, does everybody see the image? Okay. Ezra, not sure why some people would be able to see it and others not. Okay. I'll now turn the page. The Shivchei HaBesht was an early collection. Can you see this? I've changed the page. Okay, I'm not getting the kind of response here. Rafi, are you there? Okay, Rafi, can you see this picture on the screen? Yes, okay. So apparently some people can see this and some people can't. I apologize. I'm not sure. I'm not sure why that would be. Ezra will look into it. So the Shivchei HaBesht is a collection of early tales, of wonder tales, as it were, about the Baal Shem Tov. And they describe his biography, as it were, his life, his works, his revelation, etc. The first edition of the Shivchei HaBesht was composed in about 1814. So this was quite a bit of time after the Baal Shem Tov died in 1760, but it's a very, very, very important early text, this Shivchei HaBesht. It's translated into English it's called in English, In Praise of the Baal Shem Tov. In Praise of the Baal Shem Tov. I'm pretty sure it's also available on Amazon. Chaim mentions that he sees Russian letters among the Hebrew letters. What you're looking at is a scan of the title page of the first edition, which has Russian lettering on it because it was published in Russia, and books had to be... Books here. The picture's still here, and books had to be had to have the approval of the government in order to be published. In an early section of the Shivchei HaBesht, there's this account of how the Baal Shem Tov reveals himself and becomes the Baal Shem, as it were, again around 1736. The story goes that there was this character, Rebbe Gershon. Rebbe Gershon was the Baal Shem Tov's brother-in-law. He, Rebbe Gershon, was recognized as a great spiritual figure. And the Baal Shem Tov, his brother-in-law, was considered to be a, you know, something of a simpleton. So Rebbe Gershon rents a place for the Baal Shem Tov in a certain village. I hope you can see this. Can everybody just, everybody pay attention for a second? Raise your hand from the participants panel if you can see this text in front of you. The Baal Shem Tov reveals himself. Sherry and Yair, can you see the text on the board? No. Okay, I apologize for that. What can we do to solve this? Ah, you know what? Sherry and Yair, each of you send me an email right now and I'll email it to you and you can open it up in your email. We're going to take a 2-minute timeout. Anybody else that wants it by email should send me an email right away, and I'll... Okay, I'm going to just... I'm going back to the picture of the shul that some people had missed. Yair, did you send me your email address? Okay. Okay, I'm back. Okay, look at Alan is helping you out with some instructions if you're having trouble seeing the images. Ezra, we're going to give Alan some of your salary this month because he seems to be on top of this. Okay. Okay, and we're back. Again, the Shivchei Abesht, this early description of the Baal Shem Tov's career and of his works and of his life. Again, like we've mentioned before, when we when we looked at some other texts, we have to be careful about reading these texts as historical narratives. They were not motivated by the same goals as writers of history. They were trying to record certain messages and themes and morals and etc. And you can't necessarily read them as black on white history the way that we would, you know, in theory look to to a copy of the newspaper from the 1940s if we were working on history of World War II, let's say. Even being aware, of course, that the newspaper probably sometimes or very often got things wrong, and having to account for that. But with the idea that the newspaper was trying to get an accurate description of the events that actually happened, and was less concerned with conveying larger moral themes. Here, it's the opposite. The Baal Shem Tov builds a house of seclusion in the forest. Again, this idea that the Baal Shem Tov, before his revelation, before his revealing himself as this great leader, passed himself off as a commoner, would have to go off to seclusion in order to, as it were, let his hair down, in order to have hitbodedut, in order to have seclusion and time alone to pray and meditate and to commune with the divine. He prays and studies there all day and all night, every day of the week, and he returned home only on Shabbat. He kept there white garments for the Shabbat. He also had a bathhouse and a mikveh. His wife was occupied with earning a living, and God blessed the deeds of her hand, and she was successful. They were hospitable to guests. They gave them food and drink with great respect. When a guest came, she sent for the besht, and he returned and served him. The guest never knew about the besht. The guest never suspected that he was in the presence of the holiest Jew of his generation. We have this also. There's also this kind of notion in the Kabbalistic literature and in the in Hasidic literature, and even in some Shlomo Carlebach stories about the Lamed Vav Tzadikim, the 36 hidden righteous who sustain the world, and the people amongst them don't realize that this is a hidden master. It was the Besht's custom that when he came to the city for Rosh Hashanah, he remained there for the entire month. Once during Sukkot, during Chol HaMoed Sukkot, during the intermediate days of Sukkot, our master and rabbi, Rabbi Gershon, noticed that he, the Besht, was not putting on tefillin. Now, there are different customs about this, about wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Here in Israel, it's almost universal that people do not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. But there are some communities where it was customary to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed, and that was the case in this area where the story is taking place, and that was apparently the practice of Rabbi Gershon, the Baal Shem Tov's brother-in-law, who, prior to the Baal Shem Tov's revealing himself, Rabbi Gershon was considered the greater, the more learned. And Rabbi Gershon asks him on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, why don't you put on tefillin? The Baal Shem Tov answered, I saw in the Teich, is a type of, it was Yiddish work. I saw in a Yiddish book that he who puts on tefillin during the intermediate days is sentenced to death. So the Baal Shem Tov tells him that, there's an opinion that one doesn't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed of Sukkot and Pesach. And he mentions this idea that it's susceptible to the death penalty, which seems a little severe, but it's a way of communicating that they really don't they really don't do it. They take it very seriously. The rabbi, Rabbi Gershon, became very angry that the Baal Shem Tov followed the customs, these customs, and there was no telling what the result would be. Now, this indicates already something which we'll see later in Hasidut, that as Hasidut grew, it took on various customs that were in variance with the conventional way. They weren't antinomian. They weren't breaking the law, as it were, but they were breaking the halakha. But they adopted other customs. They adopted a different nusach tefillah. Even today, those of you that may be familiar with this, the Hasidim generally daven what we call nusach sfard. Not that they're sfaradim, like Jews of Spanish descent, but they adopted a different nusach for davening. They have certain differences in their tefillah. Generally speaking, shuls in America follow straight Nusach Ashkenaz, unless you live in a place that has different customs, etc., or the kind of the minority shul in town, or you're in a particular place, maybe in Brooklyn or another more right-wing area. But an average kind of, congregation Sons of Israel, someplace in New Jersey, they're going to daven straight, regular, old-fashioned Nusach Ashkenaz. The Sfaradim, who are, of course, also Ashkenazim ethnically, they adopted a version of the tefillah, which is, 96% identical to Ashkenaz, although there are a few changes in the order of some of the tefillot, in some of the words, in the part of the text of the kedusha, and etc. They did this in order to differentiate themselves. So we see already in this early story, this proto story of the Baal Shem Tov's origins, he's already adopting practices that are at variance, although within the larger realm of halachic Judaism, but they're in variance with what seems to be the more universal practice. And in this case, not wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So Rabbi Gershon takes him to the rabbi of the community so that the rabbi would admonish him. In other words, the elder brother-in-law takes this younger brother-in-law, the more learned brother-in-law takes his apparently less learned brother-in-law to the rabbi, so that the rabbi should set him straight, as it were. Let me just turn the page. They considered the Besht to be a pious man, but as the saying goes, an uncultured person is not sin-fearing, right? Ein am haaretz yir shemayim. Right, since he's not learned, he's not going to know what to do. And if you don't know what to do, it's difficult to get it right. This rabbi that they bring him to was a very righteous man. When they came to the rabbi's house, Rabbi Gershon kissed the mezuzah, which is, of course, the practice when walking into a house. But the Besht put his hand on the mezuzah without kissing it, and Rabbi Gershon was angry at this also. How come he doesn't kiss the mezuzah? Everybody kisses the mezuzah when you come in and out. When they entered the rabbi's house, the Baal Shem Tov put aside his mask, and the rabbi saw a great light. Not a literal mask, but a figurative mask. The Baal Shem Tov, in the guise of an Am Haaretz, in the guise of a simple folk, simple man, was concealing his great spiritual power. But he kind of, as it were, telegraphs it, winks it to this rabbi, and the rabbi sees a great light. This rabbi rises up before the Baal Shem Tov. Then the Baal Shem Tov resumed the mask, and the rabbi sat down. These are all, of course, influenced. There are Kabbalistic notions here at play. And this happened several times. The rabbi was very frightened, since he did not know who he, the Baal Shem Tov, was. Sometimes he seemed to be a holy person, and at other times he seemed to be a common man. But when our master and rabbi, Rabbi Gershon, complained to him about the tefillin and about the mezuzah, the rabbi took the Baal Shem Tov aside privately and said to him, "I command you to reveal the truth to me." And the Baal Shem Tov was forced to reveal himself to this rabbi. But the Besht commanded him, in turn, not to reveal anything that had transpired. When they came out, the rabbi said to our master and rabbi, Rabbi Gershon, "I taught him a lesson, but I think he would not knowingly commit a fault against our customs. He has acted in innocence." So this rabbi, who now knows the secret, covers up, right? And it's like the rabbi, it's like uncovering you find out really who Bruce Wayne is. You find out, Clark Kent is really Superman, but you keep it to yourself. That's lahavdil elef alfei havdalot. What's going on here? You have to keep it a secret. Yes, Alan. Alan, you raised your hand? Alan? No. Rafi, did you raise your... Are these hands from before, or did somebody want to ask a question? Very good, Chaim. Very good comment about the cone of silence. Okay. When they came out, the rabbi said to Rabbi Gershon, I taught him a lesson, da, 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 it was a mistake. Then the rabbi examines the mezuzah and discovered that it had a defect. In other words, as part of the story, the Baal Shem Tov was able to discern that the mezuzah was puzzle, right? In other words, like Clark Kent, he's got the X-ray vision. He can see he can sense, he can intuit that the mezuzah is puzzle, which is why he didn't kiss it. So we see, all of these themes together wrapped up in the story. The Baal Shem Tov is hidden. He can reveal himself, as it were, to people of a particular stature. This particular rabbi, we don't know who the rabbi is. He's got certain wonder-working powers, etc., etc., etc. But the movement that he's starting to launch is not appreciated initially by everyone. There's a subsequent story, the next story in the collection, where he then really lets the cat out of the bag, and reveals himself to everyone. I'm going to skip that now for time. Unfortunately, we lost some time in trying to get organized. But I recommend that you look at them. If you're interested, there are stories even about his origin, about his childhood, and you can check them out in this collection, which Alan, I think, sent a link to the collection in English. The whole collection in Hebrew, I'm sure, is also available online. If you Google Shivchei HaBesht, you'll find it online. There's a very good website. I don't know if you know about it. Called Hebrew Books Online. Let me find that for you. Yeah. Hebrew Books, all one word. Hebrewbooks.org, and they've scanned, at this point they've scanned 40 over 40,000 classical Hebrew books, and basically any Hebrew book that is in the common domain has been scanned and been uploaded and is available on this website, usually by PDF. And there are a few different editions. There are three different editions, two different editions of the Shivchei HaBesht, including a more modern one, available in Hebrew, online from that website, if you're interested. And the Hebrew's quite, it's fairly simple. There are plenty of there are many, 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 many fine books about the Baal Shem Tov, popular books, academic books, biographical books, hagiographical books, etc. There's no end to it. As the Baal Shem Tov, or as a Baal Shem, he has a number of different roles. One is, kind of this role that was occupied by other Baalei Shem, other wonder workers, that has to do with healing and clairvoyance and communicating with spirits, amulets, using amulets. To be clear, magical powers don't play a central role in Hasidic thought, but let's say they're useful attractions to followers who are basically, the superstitious common folk. More importantly, the Baal Shem Tov is the carrier of a religious message. One of his two most prominent Talmidim was Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. And Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was a traditional Lamdan. He was a traditional, kind of figure who was immersed in the world of conventional rabbinic learning, and he was attracted to Hasidus, he was attracted to the Baal Shem Tov, because of, specifically, he says, because of the Baal Shem Tov's ecstatic davening. In the Shivrei HaBesht and in other Hasidic writings, there's this notion, there's this motif that returns again and again of the davening of the Baal Shem Tov, that his power of ecstatic prayer had the potential to do all types of things, to intervene with heaven, as it were. And that leads to dvekut, this notion of, I just have it written here. Let me just turn the page. This notion of dvekut, of communion with heaven, of communion with God. The Hebrew term, there you go. The Hebrew term dvekut, which literally means to cleave or to stick, like debek is glue, the Baal Shem Tov had this power of communion, of attaching himself to the divine and helping others achieve this as well. The Baal Shem Tov was active in spreading Chassidut and its messages in a letter after he is revealed as the Baal Shem Tov. In a letter to Rabbi Gershon, he writes that he experienced Aliyat Nishama, that his soul, as it were, his soul goes up. It was a way of let's say communing with heaven. That you know he remains on earth. It doesn't mean that he died. It means that his soul, as it were, is able to leave this world temporarily and commune with Eliyahu HaNavi or with Malachim, or in this letter to his brother-in-law, he meets the Mashiach, who's in waiting. He meets the Messiah, who's someplace, like off in the wings, waiting before he can come and save the world. And the Baal Shem Tov asks him, "When are you coming? When are you going to come and save the world?" And in this letter, the Baal Shem Tov says that the Mashiach told him, I'll come when what you have learned is revealed in the world and our inner sources flow out and spread what I have taught to you. And they too can make Jews like you. In other words, there's a missionary impulse that we have to go and we have to spread the word of Chassidut. And what is that word? So it's the care and the support for Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people. The role of the tzaddik, what we call today the Rebbe, or the Admor, the leader of Chassidut, was called more commonly in the early years, was called the tzaddik, the righteous one. That the role of the tzaddik is to intervene on behalf of the Jewish people. The Baal Shem Tov says that he foresaw all different types of gzerot, bad things that were going to happen to the Jewish people, and he intervened on their behalf. Now in the stories, sometimes that means he goes up to heaven and intervenes on their behalf, but sometimes it also means just making sure that everything down here is all working out properly. The question, it's a historical question. Why was Chassidut so successful? Why did it attract so many followers so quickly? So there are two different two main views on this question about the incredibly successful spread of Chassidut. One is a more sociological view, and one is the more messianic view. The sociological view looks to some of the things that we talked about in the last session. They see that the Jewish communal organization by the mid-17th century was in a deep crisis. After Gzerot Tach V'Tat in 1648 and 49, there's just a tremendous amount of death and destruction. The death of individuals, the destruction of conventional rabbinic leadership, of communal leadership. This leads to the catastrophe of Sabbatianism, which we also discussed last time, this very widespread false messianic movement, which, when it collapses, leads to a terribly bitter disappointment. In 1764, the Vad Arba Artsot, that important transnational organization, the kind of the umbrella organization of the Jewish community, was shut down. In 1772, the first partition of Poland occurred. Poland was partitioned, was divided a number of times. Joel, perhaps you're in a better position to describe this. I imagine. I wonder if this is something that's taught. Is this like, is this, what you learn about in... Oh, Joel's not with us? Oh, I'm sorry about that. Usually we have Joel Nowicki with us, joining us from Poland. But I guess Poland's been partitioned tonight, and he's not with us. But in 1772, Poland was partitioned for the first time. Now, this is an interesting phenomena, because we see that Poland is often the entity that gets kicked around by stronger forces to the east or to the west of it. We see that Poland also gets a kind of in a different way during World War II, gets chopped up. And when Poland is divided, about 600,000 Jews were annexed, as it were, into Russia. Russia takes over a large section of Poland, and suddenly these Jews who lived in Poland, and Poland was, we've seen a few times, despite its really unfortunate and terrible ending, the history of the Jews in Poland wasn't a bad one. Poland was a pretty tolerant society of Jews going about their own business, which led to, of course, the incredibly rich Jewish culture, religious culture, in Eastern Europe through many centuries. But suddenly, in 1764, in 1772, Poland is partitioned, and a very large segment, perhaps up to 600,000 Jews, are now part of Tsarist Russia, which is a little more hostile and is a little less supportive and a little less friendly to the Jewish community. And that leads to a need for a new response to Jewish life, and Hasidut fills the gap. There's a small group of wealthy Jews who, in the absence of the Vad Arba Artsot, usurp leadership of the Jewish community, and this leads to all different types of exploitation of the communal structures in order for people to extend their power and wealth. And this kind of economic and social pressure leads to a rift between the masses and the upper class. And Hasidus leads to or it emerges as a type of opposition to this rift, because Hasidus has this emphasis on the power, the spiritual power of the common man. And it's a kind of social protest movement. The Baal Shem Tov sees the small shtetl Jews, the simple folk who are kind of, economically helpless, even spiritually helpless, and he develops a doctrine of serving God through joy, of serving God through faith. The question of what does God really want? What's the proper or the ideal mode of serving God? So there's a de-emphasis on Talmud Torah, on Torah study, which was the central mode of serving God. Certainly, you know, for most of your Eastern European Jewry, certainly, of course, we're talking only about men, but when we talk about Avodas Hashem, that's generally, you know, what we're talking about. The whole question of what women's inner life was like is an important but separate question. But if we're looking at the face of public religion, we're looking, of course, at men. I'm not making a value judgment. I'm making a descriptive judgment. And the Baal Shem Tov says no, quoting the Gemara, Rachmana Liba Boy, that God wants your heart. In the debate between the heart and the head, between emotion and intellect. So the Baal Shem Tov says, no, we, the simple common folk, we're the people of the heart. We're the people of the spirit. It's a reevaluation of traditional values and emphases. And these are the outlines of some of the sociological components that led to the rapid success of the movement. However, there's also an ideological or a theological or a messianic component, and that's a reaction to the unfulfilled expectations after Shabtai Tzvi. The overwhelming majority, I don't have any hard data on this, but it seems to be true, the overwhelming majority of Eastern European and even beyond, but particularly in Eastern Europe, people really initially bought into, for all the reasons that we described last week, bought into the at least the possibility that Shabtai Tzvi really was Mashiach, and we were going to be redeemed, and all of our terrible, terrible suffering and the destruction and the long exile was really at or at least near an end. And the disappointment, the bitter disappointment after that, led to this unfulfilled anxiety. And the Baal Shem Tov was making a claim that we can bring the Geula, we can bring the redemption by elevating Bnei Yisrael, by elevating the Jewish people to the level of the Dor De'ah. The Dor De'ah, the generation of knowledge. Not knowledge not simply knowledge of Torah, which had been kind of the conventional mode, but knowledge of our spiritual powers. That's what he describes in that letter to his brother-in-law, the message that he received from the Mashiach. This was not the attitude of conventional Kabbalah. Chassidut, in many, many ways, is a popularization of Kabbalistic notions. It's informed by many Kabbalistic notions and practices, but it is not a carbon copy, cut and paste of the Kabbalistic circles. The Kabbalists tried to elevate the spiritual achievements of the elite. The Kabbalists thought that if we take, we were talking about the Ari last time, that if you had a small select group of the spiritual elite together, we could work to bring the redemption. Chassidut said no. We need to work to elevate the common folk. It's a question of which end of the pyramid are we focusing on? Are we focusing on the elite, and through their powers and their talents, we can affect a change in the heavenly order? Or do we look at the broad foot soldiers, the common Jew, and realize that they're endowed with untapped spiritual powers. So in that sense, again, Hasidut is a populist movement, but one motivated by a very clear messianic impulse. You know, and clearly the success of Hasidut was a function of both of these. In 1760, when the Baal Shem Tov dies, there was a secession question. The leadership was unclear. It wasn't obvious. Who becomes the next Baal Shem Tov, or who becomes the next leader of the movement, and how that would work? The Baal Shem Tov had two primary disciples. One was Reb Dov Ber, also known as the Magid Mimizrich. The Magid is a type of a preacher. That was his title. He was known as the Magid, the preacher, the teacher, the Magid of Mizrich. Mizrich again is this town in the Ukraine. The other is Reb Yaakov Yosef Mipolno. He's known as the Toldot Yaakov Yosef, after the name of a book. Ultimately, the leadership passes to Reb Dov Ber, to the Magid of Mizrich, but Reb Yaakov Yosef writes this book in 1780. The Toldot Yaakov Yosef, which is probably the most important first generation Hasidic text. It's still studied today. And the Toldot Yaakov Yosef is the first formulation of Hasidic thought. It's organized as, like many important Hasidic texts, it's organized as Divrei Torah around the cycle of the Parshiot, but it's the first important written formulation of Hasidut. The Magid, Reb Dov Ber, had a different leadership style. We see this very often in the second generation. To be the founder of a movement is very difficult. To be the second generation leader of a movement is somehow, in some ways, more difficult still, because your job is to continue what somebody else did. The first generation is usually very charismatic. The second generation has to be more bureaucratic. The job is to keep the movement alive and keep it afloat in the absence of the charismatic leader. Reb Dov Ber was not the same type of powerful charismatic leader that the Baal Shem Tov was, and he instead begins to send out his students throughout Eastern Europe to spread the message, and this sets a pattern that we'll see until today on how Hasidut works. In the third generation, from the mid-1770s and on, let's say, the basic pattern of leadership and succession gets set. Instead of having one leader of Hasidut, you have local centers, and those local centers, those local courts, Hasidic courts, or the chatzer of different Hasidic rabbis, and then later what gets known as dynasties. Oops, one second. Where do we have it? Here, there's a link here. I found, I can't promise that it's complete, but this link to on Wikipedia, of course, there's a list of all Hasidic dynasties, and where they're from and where they're founded and who leads them and who led them and etc., if this is something that interests you. But the idea of localized leadership instead of global leadership is a function of the breakup of lines of communication, the subsequent divisions of Poland and Lithuania. Again, Poland is divided in 1772, 1793, and 1795. So there's constant, the borders are constantly shifting. Now, there's one morning you you wake up and you live in Poland. The next morning you wake up and your address is Lithuania or Russia. So, you know, suddenly the people that live 10 miles down the road are in a foreign country. And this kind of breakup leads to a localization of Hasidic leadership instead of having one kind of global leader. But most importantly, the Hasidic model of having local rebbes or tzaddikim with a court of Hasidim around them is a function of one of the main ideological components of Hasidut, and that is the role of the Rebbe, the role of the Tzaddik, which has an emphasis on a personal relationship with that teacher, with that figure. In the chat, I think Sherry had said something about it, reminding her of the Pope. In some ways, the notion that not that the Rebbe doesn't have more mitzvot than the Hasidim, the Rebbe isn't inherently more spiritually more holy than the tzaddikim. Everybody at least is of equal potential, but the Rebbe is somebody who seems to have actualized that potential in a fuller way, and can serve as a stimulant to the Hasidim to reach higher heights of themselves. And this leads to this kind of, you know, a radical new type of Jewish leadership, a type of intermediary between man and God. Perhaps this is a function of the messianic longings that Hasidut taps into, but it certainly leads to the model of Hasidut of individualized, localized courts, chatzerot, of Hasidim, and each group of Hasidim takes on their own different twist, and in each subsequent generation it becomes more and more divided and subdivided into different types of Hasidiyot with different emphases on different aspects. There are certain Hasidim that come back to the notion of Talmud Torah as the central element of Avodas Hashem. It's somewhat ironic that should happen. Each group of Hasidim have their own customs, their own practices, etc. There is some interaction between some. There's some bitter rivalry between others. Some developed in parallel. Some only split up. You know, like imagine a family tree. In other words, at one level of the tree, you have people who are your siblings. In the next level of the tree, the siblings now produce cousins. And the level after that, second cousins, etc. So levels of influence and commonality tend to break up like that. We're talking about a movement that's already been around for, let's say, if the Baal Shem Tov reveals himself in 1736, we're talking about a movement that's been around for slightly less than 300 years. It's a lot of staying power, particularly when you consider that the tragedy of the Holocaust, Hasidic Jews were particularly hard hit, statistically speaking, by the Holocaust, and yet the Hasidic dynasties and Hasidic courts are still around, both in Israel and in North America, but in other places as well. So it's a particularly resilient movement. It's impossible to even think of it as a movement. I mean, most of us, I don't think that any of us are Sfaradim. If I'm mistaken, please correct me. Most of us have some Hasidic blood running through our veins if we're not out and out Hasidim. You know, if your grandparents were in Hasidic Jews, your great grandparents, you know, if they were European, they were likely at least someplace of Hasidic stock. When people got to America, whenever they got to America, my family, in the case of my family, my great grandparents all went to America around or prior to the turn of the 20th century. That's pretty rare. Most American Jews can't say that. So I don't really have such hard and solid knowledge of what brand of Jews they were back in the old country. But certainly on my father's side, they were all from, you know, these places, the stomping ground of the Baal Shem Tov, the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains. I'm pretty sure they were Hasidic Yidden, as they say. Things change. Jews develop in different ways, and Jewish history takes different twists and turns. But Hasidut was and still is, you know, likely the most significant spiritual movement certainly in modern Jewish history. However, it was not without its opponents. And even though it spread wildly, there were attempts to block it at almost every turn. And the opposition to Hasidut, which took on the name of the Mitnagdim or the Misnagdim, led initially by the great Vilna Gaon, the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Eliyahu, and the other very often Lithuanian, but not only, opponents of Hasidut, is an interesting tale in and of itself, and we will talk about that next week. Laila Tov.